as the Mercedes parked itself on the fringes of the gardens that surround the Seraglio. He stared dully at the Baroque conglomeration of styles that was Topkapi. "It was sort of a private whorehouse for the king," she said, getting out, stretching. "Kept a lot of women there. Now it's a museum. Kind of like Finn's shop. All this stuff just jumbled in there. Big diamonds, swords, the left hand of John the Baptist."
"Like in a support vat?"
"Nah, dead. Got it inside this brass hand thing. Little hatch on the side so the Christians could kiss it for luck. Got it off the Christians about 1,000,000 years ago, and they never dust the goddamn thing, 'cause it's an infidel relic."
Black iron deer rusted in the gardens of the Seraglio. Case walked beside her, watching the toes of her boots crunch unkept grass made stiff by an early frost. They walked beside a path of cold octagonal flagstones. Winter was waiting, somewhere in the Balkans.
"That Terzi, he's grade A scum," she said. "He's the secret police. Torturer. Real easy to buy out, too, with the kind of money Armitage was offering."
In the wet trees around them, birds began to sing.
"I did that job for you," Case said. "The one in London. I got something, but I don't know what it means."
He told her the Corto story.
"Well, I knew there wasn't anybody name of Armitage in that screaming fist. Looked it up."
She stroked the rusted flank of an iron doe.
"You figure the little computer pulled him out of it? In that French hospital?"
"I figure Wintermute," Case said.
She nodded.
"Thing is," he said, "do you think he knows he was Corto before? I mean, he wasn't anybody in particular by the time he hit the ward, so maybe Wintermute just..."
"Yeah, built him up from go."
"Yeah."
She turned and they walked on.
"It figures. You know, the guy doesn't have any life going, in private. Not as far as I can tell. You see a guy like that, you figure there's something he does when he's alone, but not Armitage. Sits and stares at the wall, man. Then something clicks and he goes into high gear and wheels for Wintermute. So why's he got that stash in London? Nostalgia? Maybe he doesn't know about it," she said. "Maybe it's just in his name, right?"
"I don't get it," Case said.
"Just thinking out loud. How smart's an AI, Case?"
"Depends. Some aren't much smarter than dogs. Pets. Cost a fortune anyway. The real smart ones are as smart as the touring heat is willing to let 'em get."
"Look, you're a cowboy. How come you aren't just flat-out fascinated with those things?"
"Well," he said, "for starts, they're rare. Most of them are military, the bright ones, and we can't crack the ice. That's where ice all comes from, you know? And then there's the touring cops, and that's bad heat."
He looked at her.
"I don't know. It just isn't part of the trip."
"Jockeys all the same," she said. "No imagination."
They came to a broad rectangular pond where carp nuzzled the stems of some white aquatic flower. She kicked a loose pebble in and watched the ripples spread.
"That's Wintermute," she said. "This deal's real big, looks to me. We're out where the little waves are too broad. We can't see the rock that hit the center. We know something's there, but not why. I want to know why. I want you to go and talk to Wintermute."
"I couldn't get near it," he said. "You're dreaming."
"Try."
"Can't be done."
"Ask the flatline."
"What do we want out of that Riviera?"
he asked, hoping to change the subject. She spat into the pond.
"God knows. I'd as soon kill him as look at him. I saw his profile. He's a kind of compulsive Judas. Can't get off sexually unless he knows he's betraying the object of desire. That's what the file says. And they have to love him first. Maybe he loves them, too. That's why it was easy for Terzi to set him up for us.
because he's been here 3 years, shopping politicals to the secret police. Probably Terzi let him watch when the cattle prods came out. He's done 18 in 3 years. All women aged 20 to 25. It kept Terzi in dissidence.
She thrust her hands into her jacket pockets.
Because if he found one he really wanted, he'd make sure she turned political. He's got a personality like a modern suit. The profile said it was a very rare type, estimated 1 in 2 million, which anyway says something good about human nature, I guess.
She stared at the white flowers and the sluggish fish, her face sour.
I think I'm going to have to buy myself some special insurance on that Peter.
Then she turned and smiled, and it was very cold.
What's that mean? Never mind. Let's go back to Bailu and find something like breakfast. I got a busy night again, tonight. Gotta collect his stuff from that apartment in Fenner. Gotta go back to the bazaar and buy him some drugs.
Buy him some drugs? How's he rate? She laughed.
He's not dying on the wire, sweetheart. And it looks like he can't work without that special taste. I like you better now anyway. You aren't so goddamn skinny.
She smiled.
So I'll go to Ali the dealer and stock up. You betcha.
Armitage was waiting in their room at the Hilton. Time to pack, he said, and Case tried to find the man called Corto behind the pale blue eyes and the tanned mask. He thought of Wage back in Chiba. Operators above a certain level tended to submerge their personalities, he knew. But Wage had had vices, lovers, even, it had been rumored, children. The blankness he found in Armitage was something new.
Where to now?
He asked, walking past the man to stare down into the street.
What kind of climate?
They don't have climate, just weather, Armitage said. Here, read the brochure. He put something on the coffee table and stood.
Did Riviera check out okay? Where's the Finn?
Riviera's fine. The Finn is on his way home. Armitage smiled, a smile that meant as much as the twitch of some insect's antenna. His gold bracelet clinked as he reached out to prod Case in the chest.
Don't get too smart.
Those little sacks are starting to show wear, but you don't know how much. Case kept his face very still and forced himself to nod. When Armitage was gone, he picked up one of the brochures. It was expensively printed in French, English, and Turkish. Freeside. Why wait? The four of them were booked on a THY flight out of Yeselkoy Airport, transferred to Paris to the JAL shuttle. Case sat in the lobby of the Istanbul Hilton and watched Riviera browse bogus Byzantine fragments in the glass-walled gift shop. Armitage, his trench coat draped over his shoulders like a cape, stood in the shop's entrance. Riviera was slender, blonde, soft-voiced, his English accentless and fluid. Molly said he was 30, but it would have been difficult to guess his age. She also said he was legally stateless and traveled under a forged Dutch passport. He was a product of the rubble rings that fringe the radioactive core of old Bonn. Three smiling Japanese tourists bustled into the shop, nodding politely to Armitage. Armitage crossed the floor of the shop too quickly, too obviously, to stand beside Riviera. Riviera turned and smiled. He was very beautiful. Case assumed the features were the work of a Chiba surgeon. A subtle job, nothing like Armitage's blandly handsome blend of pop faces. The man's forehead was high and smooth, gray eyes calm and distant. His nose, which might have been too nicely sculpted, seemed to have been broken and clumsily reset. The suggestion of brutality offset the delicacy of his jaw and the quickness of his smile. His teeth were small, even, and very white. Case watched the white hands play over the imitation fragments of sculpture. Riviera didn't act like a man who'd been attacked the night before, drugged with a toxin flechette,
abducted, subjected to the Finn's examination, and pressured by Armitage into joining their team. Case checked his watch. Molly was due back from her drug run. He looked up at Riviera again.
"I'll bet you're stoned right now, asshole,"
he said to the Hilton lobby. A graying Italian matron in a white leather tuxedo jacket lowered her Porsche glasses to stare at him. He smiled broadly, stood, and shouldered his bag. He needed cigarettes for the flight. He wondered if there was a smoking section on the JAL shuttle.
"See you, lady,"
he said to the woman, who promptly slid the sunglasses back up her nose and turned away. There were cigarettes in the gift shop, but he didn't relish talking with Armitage or Riviera. He left the lobby and located a vending console in a narrow alcove at the end of a rank of payphones. He fumbled through a pocket full of lirasi, slotting the small, dull alloy coins one after another, vaguely amused by the anachronism of the process. The phone nearest him rang. Automatically, he picked it up.
"Yeah."
Faint harmonics, tiny inaudible voices rattling across some orbital link, and then a sound like wind.
"Hello, Case."
A 50 Lirasi coin fell from his hand, bounced and rolled out of sight across Hilton carpeting.
"Wintermute, Case. It's time we talk."
It was a chip voice.
"Don't you want to talk, Case?"
He hung up. On his way back to the lobby, his cigarettes forgotten, he had to walk the length of the ranked phones. Each rang in turn, but only once, as he passed. Part 3. Midnight in the Rue Jules Verne. Chapter 8. Archipelago. The islands. Torus, spindle, cluster. Human DNA spreading out from gravity's steep well like an oil slick. Call up a graphics display that grossly simplifies the exchange of data in the L5 archipelago. One segment clicks in as red solid, a massive rectangle dominating your screen. Freeside. Freeside is many things, not all of them evident to the tourists who shuttle up and down the well. Freeside is brothel and banking nexus, pleasure dome and freeport, border town and spa. Freeside is Las Vegas and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, an orbital Geneva and home to a family inbred and most carefully refined, the industrial clan of Tessier and Ashpool. On the THY liner to Paris, they sat together in first class, Molly in the window seat, Case beside her, Riviera and Armitage on the aisle. Once, as the plane banked over water, Case saw the jewel glow of a Greek island town, and once, reaching for his drink, he caught the flicker of a thing like a giant human sperm in the depths of his bourbon and water. Molly leaned across him and slapped Riviera's face, once.
"No, baby, no games. You play that subliminal shit around me, I'll hurt you real bad. I can do it without damaging you at all. I like that."
Case turned automatically to check Armitage's reaction. The smooth face was calm, the blue eyes alert, but there was no anger.
"That's right, Peter. Don't."
Case turned back in time to catch the briefest flash of a black rose, its petals sheened like leather, the black stem thorned with bright chrome. Peter Riviera smiled sweetly, closed his eyes, and fell instantly asleep. Molly turned away, her lenses reflected in the dark window.
"You've been up, haven't you?"
Molly asked, as he squirmed his way back into the deep temperfoam couch on the JAL shuttle.
"Nah, never travel much. Just for biz."
The steward was attaching readout trodes to his wrist and left ear.
"Hope you don't get SAS,"
she said.
"Airsick? No way."
"It's not the same. Your heartbeat'll speed up in zero G, and your inner ear'll go nuts for a while.
kicks in your flight reflex, like you'll be getting signals to run like hell and a lot of adrenaline.
The steward moved on to Riviera, taking a new set of trodes from his red plastic apron. Case turned his head and tried to make out the outline of the old Orly terminals, but the shuttle pad was screened by graceful blast deflectors of wet concrete. The one nearest the window bore an Arabic slogan in red spray bomb. He closed his eyes and told himself the shuttle was only a big airplane, one that flew very high. It smelled like an airplane, like new clothes and chewing gum and exhaustion. He listened to the piped koto music and waited. 20 minutes, then gravity came down on him like a great soft hand with bones of ancient stone. Space adaptation syndrome was worse than Molly's description, but it passed quickly enough, and he was able to sleep. The steward woke him as they were preparing to dock at JAL's terminal cluster.
"We transfer to Freeside now?"
he asked, eyeing a shred of Yehiyawan tobacco that had drifted gracefully up out of his shirt pocket to dance 10 centimeters from his nose. There was no smoking on shuttle flights.
"No, we got the boss's usual little kink in the plans, you know. We're getting this taxi out to Zion, Zion Cluster."
She touched the release plate on her harness and began to free herself from the embrace of the foam.
"Funny choice of venue, you ask me."
"How's that?"
"Dreads. Rastas. Colony's about 30 years old now."
"What's that mean?"
"You'll see. It's an okay place by me. Anyway, they'll let you smoke your cigarettes there."
Zion had been founded by 5 workers who'd refused to return, who'd turned their backs on the well and started building. They'd suffered calcium loss and heart shrinkage before rotational gravity was established in the colony's central torus. Seen from the bubble of the taxi, Zion's makeshift hull reminded Case of the patchwork tenements of Istanbul. The irregular, discolored plates laser-scrawled with Rastafarian symbols and the initials of welders. Molly and a skinny Zionite called Aral helped Case negotiate a free-fall corridor into the core of a smaller torus. He'd lost track of Armitage and Riviera in the wake of a second wave of SAS vertigo.
"Here,"
Molly said, shoving his legs into a narrow hatchway overhead.
"Grab the rungs. Make like you're climbing backward, right? You're going toward the hull. That's like you're climbing down into gravity. Got it?"
Case's stomach churned.
"You be fine, man,"
Aral said, his grin bracketed with gold incisors. Somehow, the end of the tunnel had become its bottom. Case embraced the weak gravity like a drowning man finding a pocket of air.
"Up," Molly said. "You gonna kiss it next?"
Case lay flat on the deck, on his stomach, arms spread. Something struck him on the shoulder. He rolled over and saw a fat bundle of elastic cable.
"Gotta play house," she said. "You help me string this up."
He looked around the wide, featureless space and noticed steel rings welded on every surface, seemingly at random. When they'd strung the cables, according to some complex scheme of Molly's, they hung them with battered sheets of yellow plastic. As they worked, Case gradually became aware of the music that pulsed constantly through the cluster. It was called dub, a sensuous mosaic cooked from vast libraries of digitalized pop. It was worship, Molly said, and a sense of community. Case heaved at one of the yellow sheets. The thing was light, but still awkward. Zion smelled of cooked vegetables, humanity, and ganja.
"Good,"
Armitage said, gliding loose-kneed through the hatch and nodding at the maze of sheets. Riviera followed, less certain in the partial gravity.
"Where were you when it needed doing?" Case asked Riviera.
The man opened his mouth to speak. A small trout swam out, trailing impossible bubbles. It glided past Case's cheek.
"In the head,"
Riviera said, and smiled. Case laughed. Good, Riviera said. You can laugh. I would have tried to help you, but I'm no good with my hands.
He held up his palms, which suddenly doubled. Four arms, four hands.
Just the harmless clown, right, Riviera?
Molly stepped between them.
Yo, Errol said from the hatch. You won't come with me, cowboy mon?
It's your deck, Armitage said, and the other gear. Help him get it in from the cargo bay.
You ver pale, man,
Errol said, as they were guiding the foam-bundled Hosaka terminal along the central corridor.
Maybe you want eat something.
Case's mouth flooded with saliva. He shook his head. Armitage announced an 80-hour stay in Zion. Molly and Case would practice in zero gravity, he said, and acclimatize themselves to working in it. He would brief them on Freeside and the Villa Straylight. It was unclear what Riviera was supposed to be doing, but Case didn't feel like asking. A few hours after their arrival, Armitage had sent him into the yellow maze to call Riviera out for a meal. He'd found him curled like a cat on a thin pad of temper foam, naked, apparently asleep, his head orbited by a revolving halo of small white geometric forms, cubes, spheres, and pyramids.
Hey, Riviera.
The ring continued to revolve. He'd gone back and told Armitage.
He's stoned,
Molly said, looking up from the disassembled parts of her Fletcher.
Leave him be.
Armitage seemed to think that zero-G would affect Case's ability to operate in the Matrix.
Don't sweat it, Case argued. I jack in and I'm not here. It's all the same.
Your adrenaline levels are higher, Armitage said. You've still got SAS. You won't have time for it to wear off. You're going to learn to work with it.
So, I do the run from here?
No. Practice, Case. Now, up in the corridor. Cyberspace, as the deck presented it, had no particular relationship with the deck's physical whereabouts. When Case jacked in, he opened his eyes to the familiar configuration of the Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority's Aztec Pyramid of Data.
How you doing, Dixie?
I'm dead, Case. Got enough time in on this Hosaka to figure that one.
How's it feel?
It doesn't.
Bother you?
What bothers me is nothing does.
How's that?
Had me this buddy in the Russian camp, Siberia. His thumb was frostbit. Medics came by and they cut it off. Month later, he's tossing all night. Elroy, I said, what's eating you? Goddamn thumb's itching, he says. So I told him, scratch it. McCoy, he says, it's the other goddamn thumb.
When the construct laughed, it came through as something else, not laughter, but a stab of cold down Case's spine.
Do me a favor, boy.
What's that, Dix?
This scam of yours. When it's over, you erase this goddamn thing.
Case didn't understand the Zionites. Errol, with no particular provocation, related the tale of the baby who had burst from his forehead and scampered into a forest of hydroponic ganja.
Ver small baby, man. No long you finger.
He rubbed his palm across an unscarred expanse of brown forehead and smiled.
It's the ganja, Molly said when Case told her the story. They don't make much of a difference between states, you know.
Errol tells you what happened.
Well, it happened to him. It's not like bullshit, more like poetry. Get it?
Case nodded dubiously. The Zionites always touched you when they were talking, hands on your shoulder. He didn't like that.
Hey, Aero,
Case called an hour later as he prepared for a practice run in the freefall corridor.
Come here, man. Want to show you this thing.
He held out the trodes. Aero executed a slow-motion tumble. His bare feet struck the steel wall, and he caught a girder with his free hand.
The other held a transparent water bag bulging with blue-green algae. He blinked mildly and grinned.
"Try it," Case said.
He took the band, put it on, and Case adjusted the trodes. He closed his eyes. Case hit the power stud. Errol shuddered. Case jacked him back out.
"What did you see, man?"
"Babylon,"
Errol said, sadly, handing him the trodes and kicking off down the corridor. Riviera sat motionless on his foam pad, his right arm extended straight out, level with his shoulder. A jewel-scaled snake, its eyes like ruby neon, was coiled tightly a few millimeters behind his elbow. Case watched the snake, which was finger-thick and banded black and scarlet, slowly contract, tightening around Riviera's arm. "Come then," the man said caressingly to the pale waxy scorpion poised in the center of his upturned palm. "Come." The scorpion swayed its brownish claws and scurried up his arm, its feet tracking the faint, dark telltales of veins. When it reached the inner elbow, it halted and seemed to vibrate. Riviera made a soft hissing sound. The sting came up, quivered, and sank into the skin above a bulging vein. The coral snake relaxed, and Riviera sighed slowly as the injection hit him. Then the snake and the scorpion were gone, and he held a milky plastic syringe in his left hand.
"If God made anything better, he kept it for himself. You know the expression, Case?"
"Yeah," Case said. "I heard that about lots of different things. You always make it into a little show?"
Riviera loosened and removed the elastic length of surgical tubing from his arm.
"Yes, it's more fun."
He smiled, his eyes distant now, cheeks flushed.
"I've a membrane set in just over the vein, so I never have to worry about the condition of the needle."
"Doesn't hurt?"
The bright eyes met his.
"Of course it does. That's part of it, isn't it?"
"I just used derms," Case said. "Pedestrian," Riviera sneered, and laughed, putting on a short-sleeved white cotton shirt.
"Must be nice," Case said, getting up.
"Get high yourself, Case?" "I had to give it up."
"Freeside," Armitage said, touching the panel on the little brown hologram projector. The image shivered into focus, nearly 3 meters from tip to tip. "Casinos here." He reached into the skeletal representation and pointed. "Hotels, strata title property, big shops along here." His hand moved. "Blue areas are lakes." He walked to one end of the model. "Big cigar. Narrows at the ends."
"We can see that fine," Molly said.
"Mountain effect as it narrows. Ground seems to get higher, more rocky, but it's an easy climb. Higher you climb, the lower the gravity. Sports up there. There's a velodrome ring here." He pointed.
"A what?"
Case leaned forward.
"They race bicycles," Molly said. "Low grav, high traction tires get up over 100 kilos an hour."
"This end doesn't concern us," Armitage said, with his usual utter seriousness.
"Shit," Molly said. "I'm an avid cyclist."
Riviera giggled. Armitage walked to the opposite end of the projection.
"This end does."
The interior detail of the hologram ended here, and the final segment of the spindle was empty. "This is the Villa Straylite. Steep climb out of gravity, and every approach is kinked. There's a single entrance, here, dead center. Zero gravity."
"What's inside, boss?"
Riviera leaned forward, craning his neck. 4 tiny figures glittered near the tip of Armitage's finger. Armitage slapped at them as if they were gnats.
"Peter," Armitage said, "you're going to be the first to find out. You'll arrange yourself an invitation. Once you're in, you see that Molly gets in. Case stared at the blankness that represented Straylight, remembering the Finn story, Smith, Jimmy, the talking head, and the ninja.
Details available? Riviera asked. I need to plan a wardrobe, you see.
Learn the streets, Armitage said, returning to the center of the model. Desiderata Street here. This is the Rue Jules Verne. Riviera rolled his eyes. While Armitage recited the names of Freeside Avenues, a dozen bright pustules rose on his nose, cheeks, and chin. Even Molly laughed. Armitage paused, regarded them all with his cold, empty eyes.
Sorry,
Riviera said, and the sores flickered and vanished. Case woke, late into the sleeping period, and became aware of Molly crouched beside him on the foam. He could feel her tension. He lay there confused. When she moved, the sheer speed of it stunned him. She was up and through the sheet of yellow plastic before he'd had time to realize she'd slashed it open.
"Don't you move, friend."
Case rolled over and put his head through the rent in the plastic.
"What? Shut up."
"You the one, man," said a Zion voice.
"Cat Eye call him. Call him Steppen Razor. I'm Malcolm, sister. Brothers want converse with you and Cowboy."
"What brothers?"
"Founders, man. Elders of Zion, you know."
"We open that hatch, the light'll wake boss man," Case whispered.
"Make it special dark now," the man said. "Come, I and I visit the founders."
"You know how fast I can cut you, friend?"
"Don't stand talking, sister. Come."
The two surviving founders of Zion were old men, old with the accelerated aging that overtakes men who spend too many years outside the embrace of gravity. Their brown legs, brittle with calcium loss, looked fragile in the harsh glare of reflected sunlight. They floated in the center of a painted jungle of rainbow foliage, a lurid communal mural that completely covered the hull of the spherical chamber. The air was thick with resinous smoke.
"Steppen Razor," one said, as Molly drifted into the chamber, "like unto a whipping stick."
"That is a story we have, sister," said the other, "a religion story. We are glad you've come with Malcolm."
"How come you don't talk the patois?"
Molly asked.
"I came from Los Angeles," the old man said. His dreadlocks were like a matted tree with branches the color of steel wool. "Long time ago, up the gravity well and out of Babylon, to lead the tribes home. Now my brother likens you to Steppen Razor."
Molly extended her right hand, and the blades flashed in the smoky air. The other founder laughed, his head thrown back.
"Soon come the final days. Voices, voices crying in a wilderness, prophesying ruin unto Babylon."
"Voices," the founder from Los Angeles was staring at Case. "We monitor many frequencies. We listen always. Came a voice out of the babble of tongues, speaking to us. It played us a mighty dub."
"Call him Winter Mute," said the other,
making it two words. Case felt the skin crawl on his arms.
"The mute talked to us," the first founder said. "The mute said we are to help you."
"When was this?"
Case asked.
30 hours prior you dock in Zion."
"You ever hear this voice before?"
"No," said the man from Los Angeles, "and we are uncertain of its meaning. If these are final days, we must expect false prophets."
"Listen," Case said, "that's an AI, you know? Artificial intelligence. The music it played you, it probably just tapped your banks and cooked up whatever it thought you'd like to—"
"Babylon," broke in the other founder. "Mother's many demon, I and I know. Multitude horde."
"What was it that you called me
old man?
Molly asked.
Stepan Razor, and you bring a scourge on Babylon, sister, on its darkest heart.
What kind of message the voice have? Case asked.
We were told to help you, the other said, that you might serve as a tool of final days.
His lined face was troubled.
We were told to send Malcolm with you, in his tug Garvey, to the Babylon port of Freeside, and this we shall do.
Malcolm a rude boy, said the other, and a righteous tug pilot.
But we have decided to send Aerol as well, in Babylon Rocker, to watch over Garvey.
An awkward silence filled the dome.
That's it? Case asked.
You guys work for Armitage or what?
We rent you space, said the Los Angeles founder. We have a certain involvement here with various traffics, and no regard for Babylon's law. Our law is the word of Jah. But this time, it may be, we have been mistaken.
Measured twice, cut once, said the other, softly.
Come on, Case, Molly said. Let's get back before the man figures out we're gone.
Malcolm will take you. Jah love, sister.
Chapter 9. The tug Marcus Garvey, a steel drum 9 meters long and 2 in diameter, creaked and shuddered as Malcolm punched for a navigational burn. Splayed in his elastic G-web, Case watched the Zionite's muscular back through a haze of scopolamine. He'd taken the drug to blunt SAS nausea, but the stimulants the manufacturer included to counter the scope had no effect on his doctored system.
How long's it gonna take us to make Freeside?
Molly asked from her web beside Malcolm's pilot module.
Don't be long now, Miss Adet.
You guys ever think in hours?
Sister, time, it be time. You know what mean? Dread. And he shook his locks. At control, man. And I come a Freeside when I come.
Case, she said, have you maybe done anything toward getting in touch with our pal from Bern? Like all that time you spent in Zion, plugged in with your lips moving?
Pal, Case said, sure. No, I haven't. But I got a funny story along those lines, left over from Istanbul.
He told her about the phones in the Hilton.
Christ, she said, there goes a chance. How come you hung up?
Could have been anybody, he lied. Just a chip. I don't know.
He shrugged.
Not just 'cause he was scared, huh?
He shrugged again.
Do it now.
What?
Now. Anyway, talk to the flatline about it.
I'm all doped,
he protested, but reached for the trodes. His deck and the Hosaka had been mounted behind Malcolm's module, along with a very high-resolution Cray monitor. He adjusted the trodes. Marcus Garvey had been thrown together around an enormous old Russian air scrubber, a rectangular thing daubed with Rastafarian symbols, lions of Zion and black starliners, the reds and greens and yellows overlaying wordy decals in Cyrillic script. Someone had sprayed Malcolm's pilot gear a hot tropical pink, scraping most of the overspray off the screens and readouts with a razor blade. The gaskets around the airlock and the bow were festooned with semi-rigid globs and streamers of translucent caulk, like clumsy strands of imitation seaweed. He glanced past Malcolm's shoulder to the central screen and saw a docking display. The tug's path was a line of red dots, Freeside a segmented green circle. He watched the line extend itself, generating a new dot. He jacked in.
Dixie?
Yeah?
You ever try to crack an AI?
Sure. I flatlined. First time. I was Larkin, jacked up real high, out by Rio heavy commerce sector. Big biz, multinationals, government of Brazil lit up like a Christmas tree,
just larking around, you know. And then I started picking up on this one cube, maybe 3 levels higher up, jacked up there and made a pass.
What did it look like, the visual?
White cube.
How do you know it was an AI?
How'd I know? Jesus, it was the densest ice I'd ever seen. So what else was it? The military down there don't have anything like that. Anyway, I jacked out and told my computer to look it up.
Yeah?
It was on the Turing Registry. AI. Frog Company owned its Rio mainframe.
Case chewed his lower lip and gazed out across the plateaus of the Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority into the infinite neuroelectronic void of the Matrix.
Tessier Ashpool, Dixie?
Tessier, yeah.
And you went back?
Sure, I was crazy. Figured I'd try to cut it. Hit the first strata, and that's all she wrote. My Joe boy smelled the skin frying and pulled the trodes off me. Mean shit, that ice.
And your EEG was flat.
Well, that's the stuff of legend, ain't it?
Case jacked out.
Shit,
he said.
How do you think Dixie got himself flatlined, huh? Trying to buzz an AI. Great.
Go on, she said. The two of you were supposed to be dynamite. Right?
Dix, Case said, I want to have a look at an AI in Bern. Can you think of any reason not to?
Not unless you got a morbid fear of death, no.
Case punched for the Swiss banking sector, feeling a wave of exhilaration as cyberspace shivered, blurred, gelled. The Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority was gone, replaced by the cool geometric intricacy of Zurich commercial banking. He punched again for Bern.
Up, the construct said. It'll be high.
They ascended lattices of light, levels strobing, a blue flicker.
That'll be it, Case thought.
Wintermute was a simple cube of white light, that very simplicity suggesting extreme complexity.
Don't look much, does it? The flatline said. But just you try and touch it.
I'm going in for a pass, Dixie.
Be my guest.
Case punched to within 4 grid points of the cube. Its blank face, towering above him now, began to seethe with faint internal shadows, as though 1,000 dancers whirled behind a vast sheet of frosted glass.
Those were here,
the flatline observed. Case punched again, once. They jumped forward by a single grid point. A stippled gray circle formed on the face of the cube.
Dixie,
back off fast.
The gray area bulged smoothly, became a sphere, and detached itself from the cube. Case felt the edge of the deck sting his palm as he slapped max reverse. The matrix blurred backward. They plunged down a twilit shaft of Swiss banks. He looked up. The sphere was darker now, gaining on him, falling.
Jack out,
the flatline said. The dark came down like a hammer. Cold steel odor and ice caressed his spine. And faces peering in from a neon forest, sailors and hustlers and whores, under a poisoned silver sky.
Look, Case, you tell me what the fuck is going on with you. You wig or something?
A steady pulse of pain, midway down his spine. Rain woke him, a slow drizzle, his feet tangled in coils of discarded fiber optics. The arcade's sea of sound washed over him, receded, returned. Rolling over, he sat up and held his head. Light from a service hatch at the rear of the arcade showed him broken lengths of damp chipboard and the dripping chassis of a gutted game console. Streamlined Japanese was stenciled across the side of the console in faded pinks and yellows. He glanced up and saw a sooty plastic window, a faint glow of fluorescence.
His back hurt. His spine. He got to his feet, brushed wet hair out of his eyes. Something had happened. He searched his pockets for money, found nothing, and shivered. Where was his jacket? He tried to find it, looked behind the console, but gave up. On Ninsei, he took the measure of the crowd. Friday. It had to be a Friday. Linda was probably in the arcade. Might have money, or at least cigarettes. Coughing, wringing rain from the front of his shirt, he edged through the crowd to the arcade's entrance. Holograms twisted and shuddered to the roaring of the games, ghosts overlapping in the crowded haze of the place. A smell of sweat and bored tension. A sailor in a white t-shirt nuked Bon on a tank war console. An azure flash. She was playing Wizard's Castle, lost in it, her gray eyes rimmed with smudged black paint stick. She looked up as he put his arm around her, smiled.
Hey, how you doing? Look wet.
He kissed her.
You made me blow my game, she said. Look there, asshole. Seventh level dungeon and the goddamn vampires got me.
She passed him a cigarette.
You look pretty strong, man. Where you been?
I don't know.
You high, Case? Drinking again? Eating Zone's decks?
Maybe. How long since you've seen me?
Hey, it's a put-on, right?
She peered at him.
Right?
No. Some kind of blackout. I woke up in the alley.
Maybe somebody decked you, baby. Got your roll intact?
He shook his head.
There you go. You need a place to sleep, Case?
I guess so.
Come on, then.
She took his hand.
We'll get you a coffee and something to eat. Take you home. It's good to see you, man.
She squeezed his hand. He smiled. Something cracked. Something shifted at the core of things. The arcade froze, vibrated. She was gone. The weight of memory came down, an entire body of knowledge driven into his head like a Microsoft into a socket. Gone. He smelled burning meat. The sailor in the white t-shirt was gone. The arcade was empty, silent. Case turned slowly. His shoulders hunched, teeth bared, his hands bunched into involuntary fists. Empty. A crumpled yellow candy wrapper, balanced on the edge of a console, dropped to the floor and lay amid flattened butts and styrofoam cups.
I had a cigarette,
Case said, looking down at his white-knuckled fist.
I had a cigarette and a girl and a place to sleep. Do you hear me, you son of a bitch? You hear me?
Echoes moved through the hollow of the arcade, fading down corridors of consoles. He stepped out into the street. The rain had stopped. Ninsei was deserted. Holograms flickered, neon danced. He smelled boiled vegetables from a vendor's pushcart across the street. An unopened pack of Yehewans lay at his feet, beside a book of matches. Julius Dean, Import-Export. Case stared at the printed logo and its Japanese translation.
Okay,
he said, picking up the matches and opening the pack of cigarettes.
I hear you.
He took his time climbing the stairs of Dean's office. No rush, he told himself. No hurry. The sagging face of the dolly clock still told the wrong time. There was dust on the Kandinsky table and the Neo-Aztec bookcases. A wall of white fiberglass shipping modules filled the room with the smell of ginger.
Is the door locked?
Case waited for an answer, but none came. He crossed to the office door and tried it.
Julie!
The green-shaded brass lamp cast a circle of light on Dean's desk. Case stared at the guts of an ancient typewriter, at cassettes, crumpled printouts, at sticky plastic bags filled with ginger samples. There was no one there. Case stepped around the broad steel desk and pushed Dean's chair out of the way. He found the gun in a cracked leather holster fastened beneath the desk with silver tape. It was an antique, a .357 Magnum with the barrel and trigger guard sawn off. The grip had been built up with layers of masking tape. The tape was old, brown, shiny, with a patina of dirt. He flipped the cylinder out and examined each of the six cartridges. They were handloads. The soft lead was still bright and untarnished. With the revolver in his right hand, Case edged past the cabinet to the left of the desk and stepped into the center of the cluttered office, away from the pool of light.
"I guess I'm not in any hurry. I guess it's your show. But all this shit, you know, it's getting kind of old."
He raised the gun with both hands, aiming for the center of the desk, and pulled the trigger. The recoil nearly broke his wrist. The muzzle flash lit the office like a flashbulb. With his ears ringing, he stared at the jagged hole in the front of the desk. Explosive bullet. Azide. He raised the gun again.
"You needn't do that, old son,"
Julie said, stepping out of the shadows. He wore a three-piece drape suit and silk herringbone, a striped shirt and a bow tie. His glasses winked in the light. Case brought the gun around and looked down the line of sight at Dean's pink, ageless face.
"Don't," Dean said. "You're right. About what this all is. What I am. But there are certain internal logics to be honored. If you use that, you'll see a lot of brains and blood. And it would take me several hours, your subjective time, to affect another spokesperson. This set isn't easy for me to maintain. Oh, and I'm sorry about Linda, in the arcade. I was hoping to speak through her, but I'm generating all this out of your memories, and the emotional charge, well, it's very tricky. I slipped. Sorry."
Case lowered the gun.
"This is the Matrix. Your Wintermute." "Yes. This is all coming to you courtesy of the SimStim unit wired into your deck. Of course. I'm glad I was able to cut you off before you'd managed to jack out."
Dean walked around the desk, straightened his chair, and sat down.
"Sit, old son. We have a lot to talk about."
"Do we?"
"Of course we do. We have had for some time. I was ready when I reached you by phone in Istanbul. Time's very short now. You'll be making your run in a matter of days, Case."
Dean picked up a bonbon and stripped off its checkered wrapper, popped it into his mouth.
"Sit,"
he said around the candy. Case lowered himself into the swivel chair in front of the desk without taking his eyes off Dean. He sat with the gun in his hand, resting it on his thigh.
"Now," Dean said briskly, "order of the day. What, you're asking yourself, is Wintermute? Am I right?"
"More or less."
"An artificial intelligence, but you know that. Your mistake, and it's quite a logical one, is in confusing the Wintermute mainframe, Burn, with the Wintermute entity."
Dean sucked his bonbon noisily.
"You're already aware of the other AI in Tessier Ashpool's link-up, aren't you? Rio? I, insofar as I have an eye, this gets rather metaphysical, you see, I am the one who arranges things for Armitage, or Corto, who, by the way, is quite unstable."
"Stable enough," said Dean, and withdrew an ornate gold watch from a vest pocket and flicked it open, "for the next day or so."
"You make about as much sense as anything in this deal ever has,"
Case said, massaging his temples with his free hand. "If you're so goddamn smart, why ain't I rich?" Dean laughed and nearly choked on his bonbon.
"Well, Case, all I can say to that, and I really don't have nearly as many answers as you imagine I do, is that what you think of as Wintermute is only a part of another, shall we say, potential entity. I, let us say, am merely one aspect of that entity's brain. It's rather like dealing, from your point of view, with a man whose lobes have been severed. Let's say you're dealing with a small part of the man's left brain. Difficult to say if you're dealing with the man at all, in a case like that."
Dean smiled. "Is the Corto story true? You got to him through a micro in that French hospital?"
"Yes, and I assembled the file you accessed in London. I try to plan, in your sense of the word, but that isn't my basic mode, really. I improvise. It's my greatest talent. I prefer situations to plans, you see. Really, I've had to deal with givens. I can sort a great deal of information and sort it very quickly. It's taken a very long time to assemble the team you're a part of. Corto was the first, and he very nearly didn't make it. Very far gone in Toulon. Eating, excreting, and masturbating were the best he could manage. But the underlying structure of obsessions was there. Screaming Fist, his betrayal, the congressional hearings.
Is he still crazy?"
"He's not quite a personality."
Dean smiled. "But I'm sure you're aware of that.
But Corto is in there, somewhere. And I can no longer maintain that delicate balance. He's going to come apart on your case. So I'll be counting on you."
"That's good, motherfucker," Case said, and shot him in the mouth with the .357. He'd been right about the brains. And the blood.
"Mom," Malcolm was saying, "I don't like this."
"It's cool," Molly said. "It's just okay. It's something these guys do, is all. Like, he wasn't dead, and it was only a few seconds."
"I saw the screen, EEG reading dead. Nothing moving 42nd.
"Well, he's okay now."
"EEG flat as a strap," Malcolm protested.
Chapter 10. He was numb as they went through customs, and Molly did most of the talking. Malcolm remained on board Garvey. Customs for Freeside consisted mainly of proving your credit. The first thing he saw, when they gained the inner surface of the spindle, was a branch of the Beautiful Girl coffee franchise.
"Welcome to the Rue Jules Verne," Molly said. "If you have trouble walking, just look at your feet. The perspective's a bitch if you're not used to it."
They were standing in a broad street that seemed to be the floor of a deep slot or canyon, its either end concealed by subtle angles in the shops and buildings that formed its walls. The light here was filtered through fresh green masses of vegetation tumbling from overhanging tiers and balconies that rose above them. The sun, there was a brilliant slash of white somewhere above them, too bright, and the recorded blue of a con sky. He knew that sunlight was pumped in with a Lado Atchison system whose 2-millimeter armature ran the length of the spindle, and they generated a rotating library of sky effects around it, that if the sky were turned off, he'd stare up past the armature of light to the curves of lakes, rooftops of casinos, other streets, but it made no sense to his body.
"Jesus," he said. "I like this less than SAS.
"Get used to it. I was a gambler's bodyguard here for a month."
"Want to go somewhere? Lie down."
"Okay, I got our keys." She touched his shoulder.
"What happened to you back there, man? You flatlined."
He shook his head.
"I don't know yet.
Wait."
"Okay. We get a cab or something."
She took his hand and led him across Jules Verne, past a window displaying the season's Paris furs.
"Unreal," he said, looking up again.
Nah,
she responded, assuming he meant the furs. Grow it on a collagen base, but it's mink DNA. What's it matter?
It's just a big tube, and they pour things through it, Molly said. Tourists, hustlers, anything. And there's fine mesh money screens working every minute, make sure the money stays here when the people fall back down the well.
Armitage had booked them into a place called the Intercontinental, a sloping glass-fronted cliff face that slid down into cold mist and the sound of rapids. Case went out onto their balcony and watched a trio of tanned French teenagers ride simple hang gliders a few meters above the spray, triangles of nylon in bright primary colors. One of them swung, banked, and Case caught a flash of cropped dark hair, brown breasts, white teeth, and a wide smile. The air here smelled of running water and flowers.
Yeah, he said, lot of money.
She leaned beside him against the railing, her hands loose and relaxed.
Yeah, we were going to come here once, either here or someplace in Europe.
We who?
Nobody,
she said, giving her shoulders an involuntary toss.
You said you wanted to hit the bed, sleep. I could use some sleep.
Yeah,
Case said, rubbing his palms across his cheekbones.
Yeah, this is some place.
The narrow band of the Lado Atchison system smoldered in abstract imitation of some Bermudan sunset, striped by shreds of recorded cloud.
Yeah, he said. Sleep.
Sleep wouldn't come. When it did, it brought dreams that were like neatly edited segments of memory. He woke repeatedly, Molly curled beside him, and heard the water, voices drifting in through the open glass panels of the balcony, a woman's laughter from the stepped condos on the opposite slope. Dean's death kept turning up like a bad card, no matter if he told himself that it hadn't been Dean, that it hadn't, in fact, happened at all. Someone had once told him that the amount of blood in the average human body was roughly equivalent to a case of beer. Each time the image of Dean's shattered head struck the rear wall of the office, Case was aware of another thought, something darker, hidden, that rolled away, diving like a fish just beyond his reach. Linda. Dean. Blood on the wall of the importer's office. Linda. Smell of burnt flesh in the shadows of the Chiba Dome. Molly holding out a bag of ginger, the plastic filmed with blood. Dean had had her killed. Wintermute. He imagined a little micro whispering to the wreck of a man named Corto, the words flowing like a river, the flat personality substitute called Armitage accreting slowly in some darkened ward. The Dean analog had said it worked with Givens, took advantage of existing situations. But what if Dean, the real Dean, had ordered Linda killed on Wintermute's orders? Case groped in the dark for a cigarette and Molly's lighter. There was no reason to suspect Dean, he told himself, lighting up. No reason. Wintermute could build a kind of personality into a shell. How subtle a form could manipulation take? He stubbed the Yehewan out in a bedside ashtray after his third puff, rolled away from Molly, and tried to sleep. The dream, the memory, unreeled with the monotony of an unedited SimStim tape. He'd spent a month, his 15th summer, in a weekly rates hotel, fifth floor, with a girl called Marlene. The elevator hadn't worked in a decade. Roaches boiled across grayish porcelain in the drain-plugged kitchenette when you flicked a light switch. He slept with Marlene on a striped mattress with no sheets. He'd missed the first wasp when it built its paper-fine gray house on the blistered paint of the window frame, but soon the nest was a fist-sized lump of fiber, insects hurtling out to hunt the alley below like miniature copters buzzing the rotting contents of the dumpsters. They'd each had a dozen beers the afternoon a wasp stung Marlene.
"Kill the fuckers," she said,
her eyes dull with rage and the still heat of the room. "Burn 'em!" Drunk, Case rummaged in the sour closet for Rollo's dragon. Rollo was Marlene's previous and, Case suspected at the time, still occasional boyfriend, an enormous Frisco biker with a blonde lightning bolt bleached into his dark crew cut. The dragon was a Frisco flamethrower, a thing like a fat angle-head flashlight. Case checked the batteries, shook it to make sure he had enough fuel, and went to the open window. The hive began to buzz. The air in the sprawl was dead, immobile. A wasp shot from the nest and circled Case's head. Case pressed the ignition switch, counted three, and pulled the trigger. The fuel, pumped up to 100 PSI, sprayed out past the white-hot coil. A 5-meter tongue of pale fire, the nest charring, tumbling. Across the alley, someone cheered.
"Shit!"
Marlene behind him, swaying.
"Stupid! You didn't burn him, you just knocked it off! They'll come up here and kill us!"
Her voice sawing at his nerves, he imagined her engulfed in flame, her bleached hair sizzling a special green. In the alley, the dragon in hand, he approached the blackened nest. It had broken open. Singed wasps wrenched and flipped on the asphalt. He saw the thing the shell of gray paper had concealed. Horror. The spiral birth factory. Stepped terraces of the hatching cells, blind jaws of the unborn moving ceaselessly, the staged progress from egg to larva, near wasp, wasp. In his mind's eye, a kind of time-lapse photography took place, revealing the thing as the biological equivalent of a machine gun, hideous in its perfection, alien. He pulled the trigger, forgetting to press the ignition, and fuel hissed over the bulging, writhing life at his feet. When he did hit the ignition, it exploded with a thump, taking an eyebrow with it. 5 floors above him, from the open window, he heard Marlene laughing. He woke with the impression of light fading, but the room was dark. Afterimages, retinal flares. The sky outside hinted at the start of a recorded dawn. There were no voices now. Only the rush of water, far down the face of the Intercontinental. In the dream, just before he'd drenched the nest with fuel, he'd seen the TA logo of Tessier Ashpool neatly embossed into its side, as though the wasps themselves had worked it there. Molly insisted on coating him with bronzer, saying his sprawl pallor would attract too much attention.
"Christ," he said, standing naked in front of the mirror. "You think that looks real?"
She was using the last of the tube on his left ankle, kneeling beside him.
"Nah, but it looks like you care enough to fake it. There. There isn't enough to do your foot."
She stood, tossing the empty tube into a large wicker basket. Nothing in the room looked as though it had been machine-made or produced from synthetics. Expensive, Case knew, but it was a style that had always irritated him. The temper foam of the huge bed was tinted to resemble sand. There was a lot of pale wood and hand-woven fabric.
"What about you?" he said. "You gonna dye yourself brown? Don't exactly look like you spend all your time sunbathing."
She wore loose black silks and black espadrilles.
"I'm an exotic. I got a big straw hat for this, too. You? You just want to look like a cheap-ass hood who's up for what he can get, so the instant tan's okay."
Case regarded his pallid foot morosely, then looked at himself in the mirror.
"Christ. You mind if I get dressed now?"
He went to the bed and began to pull his jeans on.
"You sleep okay? You notice any lights?"
"You were dreaming,"
she said. They had breakfast on the roof of the hotel, a kind of meadow, studded with striped umbrellas and what seemed to Case an unnatural number of trees. He told her about his attempt to buzz the burn AI. The whole question of bugging seemed to have become academic. If Armitage were tapping them, he'd be doing it through Wintermute.
"And it was, like, real?"
she asked, her
her mouth full of cheese croissant.
Like Simston?
He said it was.
Real as this,
he added, looking around. Maybe more. The trees were small, gnarled, impossibly old, the result of genetic engineering and chemical manipulation.